Okay. Yeah. Thank you for the chance to talk. So I am entering my middle years. This is a time when, whether you like it or not, whether you feel like you're a stereotype or not, you often kind of start thinking about the big picture. What have I done with my life? Where am I going? So I'm gonna not make it personal. I'm gonna talk about factorization algebras. You know, one of the things I've worked on over the last 15 years or so is factorization algebras, which I'll talk about what those are, kind of review what they are later in the talk. But they're these local to global objects that Kevin and I have used for various purposes and people have used for other purposes. And I am wondering, like, what's the lesson to take away from them? What are they useful for and maybe not useful for, since I've spent so much time on them? I'm trying to figure out what to do with my few remaining years. Okay, another source of reflection is that these recent snowmass papers have been interesting to look at just to sort of see what the community, say, in mathematical physics has taken away from what Kevin and I have done and other people have done with factorization algebras. So far as I can tell, the broad impression, so the general impression in mathematical physics, boils down to two things in answer to this question: what are they good for? Or what role do they play in mathematical physics? So one of them is they are a cousin, they are the Euclidean field theory cousin of algebraic quantum field theory. So there's this like work in mathematical physics going back many decades attempting to understand to define QFT in the Lorentzian setting. It's abbreviated AQFT. I won't dwell on that too much. You don't need to know what it is, but that's one of the things people sort of condense it to. Another thing you sort of hear is factorization algebras just know about perturbative theories. And I think it's not a surprise that these are the takeaway messages people have. They're sort of the things we tend to emphasize when we talk about factorization algebras. You know, the motivational pitch we give for factorization algebras is often as some sort of structure that you can see a QFT has to have, and the story is not so different from what you hear there as a motivational story. But maybe just as a small comment, for those of you who are broader mathematicians, factorization algebras are used for all kinds of things having nothing to do with quantum field theory. So I think that's useful to know. They show up in topology and representation theory, sort of internally to that with no connection. The other thing is the only general result I know about, sort of very big picture general result I know about factorization algebras so far, or that we tend to talk about, is this work with Kevin that we wrote a long book about, which is that if you have a perturbative sort of Riemannian signature field theory on a manifold M, then you get a factorization algebra on M. By asking for the observables, sort of the observables on a given open set. So this is sort of you can make this a precise theorem. I just want to advertise that you can also do this now in any signature. So Kasia Reitzner and I have been trying to understand this for a while and we're done. So a paper will show up on Monday that shows the analogous theorem using the sort of perturbative theories in Lorentzian signature. Okay. So it does seem to be a sort of uniform fact that perturbative theories are encoded in factorization algebras. So two is true, But I want to get rid of the just. That's not, I don't know if it's just that they know about perturbative things. It's true that they do know about perturbative things. The question is it all they know? Okay. So this sort of result says that they are good for some parts of field theory. The question is, are they good for other parts of theory? So the question I want to focus on today is, what kind of non-perturbative phenomena might factorization algebras know or could be used to study, to analyze? Okay, so the word non-perturbative, I kind of hate this word. It's like studying non-elephant mammals or something. It doesn't actually tell you what you're doing. It's just saying what you're not doing. But I'll list some sort of classic examples of things people talk about, and then I'll just sort of ask, so far as I know, and I'd be happy to be corrected in this talk right now, about whether anybody's attempted to use factorization algebras for that kind of question. So, for instance, there's things like instantons, monopoles, things that arise from interesting solutions to equations of motion of your classical field theory. And so far as I know, I don't know anybody's like really seriously tried to do anything.
PFN.
Say again?
PFN.
Okay.
They build an E3 algebra, which is a factorization algebra.
Awesome. Okay. Great. So let's learn something from that talk too. Things like the Witten effect, that's often something you see. I don't know that anybody's knowing about that. You have to understand something about charge lattices and theta terms. And
that would be nice studying it a little bit. Okay, maybe.
In a, so, oh, great. So, okay. Is that in a paper?
It's in our paper by Baxter's key operator.
So we'll see. We'll see how this goes. Great. So we'll be compiling a list of things to further explore. So things like line defects, surface defects. There's definitely been work in this direction, of course. Can mention Kevin and Davide and Tudor and Natalie Paquette and lots of other people. Since it's my talk, I can plug my silly stuff. I wrote a paper this summer that's a very kind of like direct attempt to take an ansatz about how to construct disorder operators and sort of explain how to capture them in factorization algebras. I think this was probably known by lots of people, but like at least available as a construction now. So there is work on certain kinds of defects. Another thing, actually formulating dualities in terms of factorization algebras, maybe. In the geometric representation theory world, there's kind of versions of this for things related to, say, geometric Langlands, but lots of people talk about them. So I'm going to bring up one last thing, which I'll focus on in the talk, which are, I'm going to focus on things related to sort of finite and discrete groups. In particular, I'm interested in talking about Dijkgraaf-Witten theory. And I'm going to explain sort of things you can see about that kind of setting using factorization algebras and what you can't see about that setting using factorization algebras. The traditional Dijkgraaf-Witten theory is a kind of gauge theory with a finite group. It's about as far away from the kind of techniques that we use here as it's possible to be. So it's a good test about like something we really understand well. It's a good test to see, can we capture parts of it in factorization algebras? So let me just not actually go into depth about Dijkgraaf-Witten theory, but just tell you a few high points if you haven't seen it. And if you have seen it, hopefully it'll just kind of jog your memory. Okay? So let's say G is a finite, so this is that Dijkgraaf-Witten theory. Suppose G is a finite group. Let's say that Bun G of a manifold M is the groupoid of G bundles over M, which you can think about as maps of groupoids from the fundamental groupoid of M into some groupoid space or whatever you want to do, e.g. This is the groupoid. If you want to think about it as a groupoid, it's a single object and the elements of G is the morphisms. Okay. So in this sense, it should be reminiscent of gauge theory. It has to do with bundles. There's no connections around because it's a finite group. You don't have to worry about connections. So gauge theory simplifies drastically. And you can write down a functorial TFT, so following the Atiyah-Siegel approach in any dimension. So it's going to go, I'm just going to write it like this. So I should do the other way. The objects are n minus 1 manifolds. The morphisms are bordisms of n manifolds. G, and it goes to the category of vector spaces. I don't want to use too much board space, so I'll just put that here. And what does ZG assign to an n minus 1 manifold? Well, what you think about is, if you'd like, let's call it sort of functions on the G bundles on M. So one of the nice things about this setting is that, in fact, the isomorphism classes of G bundles is finite. So this is isomorph. By really what I mean by this is it's the vector space spanned by isomorphism classes of G bundles. Okay, that's a really natural thing to think about. And if I have some bordism, sigma from M in to M out, I get a vector space. I get a linear map between these two vector spaces. So this map, ZG sigma from ZG of M in to ZG of M out, I'm writing small because I'm not going to tell you anything. There's some vector space. If you want, you can think of it as some sort of like scattering amplitude, but really what it is doing is counting something about principal bundles on sigma and how they restrict to the boundary, matching them up. And it's the number or whatever linear map you get here is a very direct implementation of the idea of the path integral. So what people like about Dijkgraaf-Witten theory, so what people like about this is that this is a setting. This is a setting where the path integral is well-defined. So it's a kind of proof of principle. It's also lovely because you can write down an explicit Atiyah-Siegel type TFT. You can, in principle, keep going down to one of these fully extended things. I don't know how carefully anybody's written that in a down except in very low dimensions.
Okay.
Sir?
Yeah.
Can you repeat, please? Maybe I missed. Why you say that the path integral is well defined here? Because I see no path integral.
I didn't tell you what this linear map is. And so maybe I should say what the linear map more or less is. So the linear map boils down to if I pick a principal bundle here and I pick a principal bundle here, those are boundary conditions. And I ask for what principal bundles I can put on sigma that restrict to those two principal bundles. And there'll be a bunch of them possibly. Maybe there's none, but maybe there's a couple different isomorphism classes of principal bundles on sigma that restrict. And so what you do is you count how many happen with some weighting factor. And this looks like a pattern.
Yes?
Yeah, this is all finite. So it's like, that's why it's well defined.
It's kind of finite path integral.
It's a finite path integral. Exactly.
Thank you.
I should remark that to really make it look more like a path integral, you have to pick BG into something like U1. This ends up sort of giving you can twist everything here in a way where it really becomes clear that it looks like this looks like sections of a lambda twisted line bundle and things. Anyway.
Is it kind of Planck constant, no?
I don't even know where to put that in what does that question mean? It's like a Trin-Simons level or something. Yeah.
Then it's Planck constant.
Right, it's quantized very much. Owen, to answer your question, no one's written it down, but Claudia knows how.
Oh, great. Cool, thanks. Okay. So this is the kind of thing that's like a favorite thing of, say, Dan Fried and other people who've been championing functorial TFTs for a long time. It's sort of a leading example they give. So what I'd like to do today is try to write down a factorization algebra that knows some of that data. And I'm going to point out sort of that there are things it does know and things it doesn't know vis-a-vis the Dyckhoff-Witten example. So it's a good test case for what factorization algebras can know or not know. And it's just algebraic topology, so it's quite tractable. But before I do that, maybe for those of you who aren't immediately enthralled by the question of studying covering spaces, I'd like to say why it might be useful to physics problems that people might care about who don't just care about, say, functorial field theories. Okay, so three potential applications. So if we sort of can really understand even this particular piece of non-perturbative things, there's some things that are useful that people care about already in math and physics that we might be able to do to enhance. Yeah. Okay. So here's a question that's bothered me for a long time. So is there a concrete model as a factorization algebra on C, or more general Riemann surfaces, for the lattice vertex algebra? Let me just remark that the lattice vertex algebra looks like it's built out of two pieces. There's a Heisenberg vertex algebra and basically the group Lyring of a lattice. And we do have, for the Heisenberg part, we do have a nice model. When I say nice model, I want you to bear in mind sort of, the lattice vertex algebra is well understood. There's things like the Valence and Drinfeld description of factorization algebras where there's a model for this. But those are things that I find relatively hard to work with. Just like in algebraic topology, if I just tell you the abstract definition of homology in terms of the Eilenberg-MacLane axioms, I don't necessarily have much feel for how to do anything with them. But if I have the Durham complex, I can really do explicit constructions in differential geometry and get a feel out for things. And that's what I'm looking for here, something where I really know, get my hands on it, sort of any specific concrete question. So what we're missing the group ring part. And how they interact. So another remark is, this is sort of a warm-up for a more general case. There's a lattices, sort of charge lattices, show up in lots of other settings. So charge lattices show up in abelian gauge theories, including higher abelian gauge theories, which you could think about as kind of a lower one. And knowing how to incorporate them into things like factorization algebras would be useful for understanding things like the Witten effect and some other phenomena. So there's having a good model, like sort of a good approach like this would be useful, for instance, in even formulating things like electromagnetic duality in terms of factorization algebras. Okay, so that was question one, or potential application one. If you can do this kind of thing in factorization algebras, there's lots of other downstream consequences. I want to point out that discrete and finite group gauge theories are emergent and actually interesting context. So I'm just going to mention a hopefully familiar one. So example, consider Yang-Mills-Higgs theory. With group being U1 and a complex scalar field of charge n. So that means if I'm on a manifold and I have a principal U1 bundle, so the Yang-Mills part is studying connections in that principal U1 bundle, the scalar field is a section of the associated bundle using the one-dimensional representation charge n. Okay. I think I'll use phi for that. Now, you could ask about things like, consider a solution of the equations of motion where the following two things hold. The gauge field, so the connection, is flat. And of course, the scalar, I want it to be, is a non-zero. Is non-zero. So meaning it's a solution, so it's covariant constant for this connection. It's sitting in the critical points of whatever your potential is for the Yang-Mills-Higgs. Okay. So in this setting, this is where you see the Higgs mechanism happen. What the Higgs mechanism tells you is that the perturbative theory in this around this solution, so the perturbative theory is equivalent to something with a massive vector boson, so like a Broca theory. Plus, there's just a residual real scalar field. Okay, so there's an equivalence, and you would write this totally precisely in BV language between the Yang-Mills BV theory and this BV theory. So there's actually an equivalence of factorization algebras. So there's a nice description of some part of the Higgs phase in factorization language. But this is not the entirety of the story. We're missing some part of the usual Higgs story. So we're missing something. There's a residual finite gauge symmetry. The copy of the cyclic group sitting inside of U1. Okay? And that's because that's the stabilizer of this particular solution. Okay? And so really, if we want to be a little bit smarter than this pure perturbative thing, what we really should have is this perturbative theory along with a finite group gauge theory coupled to it. Okay, that would be I would know more about the Higgs phase. Yeah.
In which observables is this residual symmetry would be visible?
That's the problem I'm asking. Is observables should sit in a factorization algebra. So how do I write down a factorization algebra that knows this finite group gauge theory information? That's the question that's missing. Is it's clear there should be something, but the methods that we usually use don't see that. Okay. So let me just write the question there. So how to encode it with factorization algebras. So a potential application, just to summarize about this situation, is I'd like to be able to talk about coupling things like finite group gauge theories to other non-topological field theories and having a factorization algebra for that whole thing so that I could do things like give a better description of a Higgs phase. Okay. There's like really recent work on this kind of thing, like in the last 10 years. Kapustin and Seiberg wrote a paper called coupling a field theory to a QFT to a topological field theory. Like, I'd like that to be a mathematically precise notion. So one last potential application, and I'll be really brief about this, but there's this paper by, I'm probably not going to say his name right, Aharoni, Seiberg, and Tachikawa, called Reading Between the Lines. And the question they're basically asking is, when we're specifying, say, a 4D gauge theory, what data do I fully need to provide to characterize a collection of line defects in that theory? I don't just say what the group is. I have to specify more information. OK. And there's some pretty subtle phenomena that happens there. So this is from like 2013. And recently, Fried, Moore, and Telemann gave a nice approach, gave an approach via functorial field theories. I'm going to draw a picture. I'm not going to explain it, but I'll explain the picture, but I won't explain their argument. I just want to point out that it exists. So their idea is the following thing. They're going to do this kind of sandwich. So there's going to be a 4D theory, 4D gauge theory. So I'm imagining living on this some four manifold here. And this is a non-topological theory. And then there's a bulk 5D theory over here. Bulk 5D sort of Dijkgraaf-Witten type theory. And then they put a 4D TFT, that's a boundary on the other side.
This is a standard picture, by the way.
I'm not claiming it's like original to them, just, and then you can collapse it down to just a 4D story. And so they interpret the sort of maneuvers done here as the different choices of sort of fillings and boundary conditions. And they sort of show off that the combinatorial kind of information that's seen here matches with the sort of things you can put here. Okay. In particular, it's kind of strange, but they don't really need, Let me just leave it at that. I'd really like to understand these kinds of arguments. People have made some attempt at a framework for that that's very mathematical. But of course, we can read these pictures in different ways. They read it in terms of functorial field theory, but you can also read them in terms of factorization algebras. There's a factorization algebra here, and actually, nobody's written down a functorial field theory that has to do with Yang-Mills. That's like way out of sight. But we can write down factorization algebras for non-topological gauge theories. And then if we could make a factorization algebra in the bulk, we could also try putting something in the boundary and just do a push forward to get a new factorization algebra. Okay. So a potential application is to capture, question, can we capture these sort of reading between the lines arguments via factorization algebras? The argument by these guys actually doesn't use very much information about the boundary. It's really mostly statements about this bulk part and the choice of boundary conditions, topological boundary conditions. So if we can write down factorization algebras, there's a chance we can just basically carry over a lot of their arguments. Okay, so that's why I want to know how to get something like Dijkgraaf-Witten theory, like a factorization algebra for it. These are things I would use it for. So that was my very lengthy introduction. And it's been 30-ish minutes, all right? OK. I really like that Kevin's making comments, but I'd be totally happy if other people did too. It's like more fun when people talk. OK, so now that was the introduction. I'm going to do a lightning review. Lightning overview of factorization algebras. If anybody wants more details, Kevin's office is just across the way. He's available for business 9 to 5. Okay. So I said a factorization algebra is a kind of local to global object. So it lives on some space. So M, some sort of space-time for my field theory. Later, we'll get kind of fancy, and you could work with a site, if you know what that is, Grothendieck site. And it's going to take value somewhere. It's a lot like a homology theory. A homology theory lives on a space and gives you back, say, vector spaces or modules. So this is going to take values in some symmetric monoidal, if you care about this kind of thing, infinity category. And I want you to think here about something like vector spaces over the complex numbers with their usual tensor product, or maybe something like chain complexes over the integers with its tensor product. Okay, so this is where a factorization algebra lives, and this is where it takes values. So let me first tell you what a pre-factorization algebra is. If you've ever seen the definition of sheaves, you'll notice the pattern we're following. Uh, I'm gonna give a gloss of the definition. A pre-factorization algebra, F on M, with values in C, is firstly a functor that goes from the open sets in M to C. Let me draw a picture for you. You might have some open set U sitting inside of some bigger open set V. And this statement just means that there's a map from F of U to F of V. So like maybe these are vector spaces and there's some linear map between them. There's also, and this is where the word algebra is coming in, some way of multiplying things that come from different open sets. So for any pairwise disjoint open sets, I don't know, U1 up to UK, all sitting inside of some big space, V. A map from F of U1 So I should have given myself more space, but I've got this big set V, and I might have, you know, U1, U2, and U3. I could take something from U1, U2, and U3, and combine them together to get something on V. Okay? And these maps satisfy some sort of natural, some constraints that might seem pretty natural. Like if I take an even bigger set W, there's some way of going from these three things up to the big thing W. There's also a way of going from V up to W. And I want to sort of say if I go from the U's up to W, it's the same thing as if I'd gone from the U's to V and then from V to W. Okay. Okay, so a prefactorization algebra is just this data of sort of what you assign to opens and then how you can multiply things if they're disjoint. You can only multiply them if they're disjoint. So what's a factorization algebra? It satisfies a local to global property, which means that if you know the behavior of F on sort of small opens, you can reconstruct F on big opens. So a factorization algebra is a prefactorization algebra. Now I'm going to say something kind of highbrow. That is a cosheaf for the Weiss topology on M. So cosheaf is some rule for how to construct things from local to global. The Weiss topology just means that you change your notion of what a cover is. So some collection of opens covers, in this Weiss sense, V, if any finite set of points in V is inside some element of the cover U alpha. Usually with a cover, you just require that if I pick any point in V, there's something in the collection of opens that contains it. But now I'm saying for any finite set of points. This condition is a very precise way of capturing the sort of physics slogan that a field theory can be reconstructed from knowing all the endpoint functions for every n.
Is the Weiss topology polygon or is it properly a site?
It's a Grundig topology. Yeah. You view opens as a site with this Grundy topology. Okay. So. Wow. I wish I was like an inch taller. That would have been a lot easier. So that's what these things are. Let me give you some examples. These are going to be examples relevant to Dijkgraaf-Witten theory. So again, so let's say that G is a discrete group. Now associated, and here, like, you know, think of things like, I don't know, the symmetric group on three letters or the integers. Those are the kind of examples I have in mind. I'm not a complicated guy. Now there are topological spaces associated to G. The main one I'm interested in is this one we talked about already. I sort of didn't even make a big deal about it, called the classifying space. So it classifies G bundles. And the usual way of saying that is if I think about the space of maps from M into BG, and maybe I take pi naught of that, this space, this is isomorphism classes of G bundles. I want to remark just to the side, if A is an abelian group, you can iterate this process. There's something called En of A, or sometimes Kan. These are called Eilenberg-MacLane spaces. And here, pi naught of the maps from M to BNA is the nth cohomology of M with coefficients A. Okay, so here was like a one mapping space, but G could be non-abelian, but if G is abelian, I can get sort of higher things. This has to do with sort of gauge theory in the usual sense. It's G bundles. These have to do with gerbs and higher gerbs, if that's your, you like that kind of thing. Okay, so now I want to use these spaces to help build my factorization algebras. So you remember in Dijkgraaf-Witten theory, the fields were this space bun G of M, which was this mapping space from M into BG. Okay, so this suggests that the observables, or some class of observables, are natural things you could measure about that space are the cohomology, the cochains. And here I just mean anything like you could take singular cochains or Durham, if that makes sense on this side, whatever model you sort of like. That's a reasonable version of observables, I think. Okay, I want to remark, there's a really natural generalization of Dijkgraaf-Witten theory where you replace EG by any finite homotopy type. So some space X whose homotopy groups are all finite, and there's only finitely many of them that aren't zero. And so just wherever I have a BG here, I could put an X. And so I'm gonna work with this sort of generalization. I'm gonna have X floating around as the target of this sigma model if you want. You can always specialize to BG if you wanna see traditional digraph Witten theory. Okay. So now I'm gonna tell you, I'm gonna take this idea that it's observables and see whether this forms a pre-factorization algebra, and then if it forms a factorization algebra. It's a very literal-minded approach. I'm just taking the fields and looking at some version of functions on them. And so the claim, there's a functor. This functor that I'm writing down doesn't just make sense on a fixed manifold M, but I could do it for, say, any N manifold. There's a functor to cheat, so I should say, and fix your favorite commutative ring. I don't know whether that's the integers or the complex numbers or whatever. So chains, chain complexes over K, and this is going to send M to the cochains of the mapping space from M to X with coefficients in K. So I'm just saying this sort of assigns, this is the observables of the X topological sigma model. And I claim is a prefactorization algebra. Okay. So why is that? I want to point out something. I'm going to factor this functor the following stages. First, there's a functor to topological spaces, and then to chain complexes. This functor is just taking cochains with values in K. And this is the mapping space functor, maps into X, right? What I want to point out is, if I have a disjoint union, M disjoint union M prime, then the mapping space from a disjoint union is isomorphic to a product space, so it sends disjoint union here to product, and if Kunneth holds, and this goes to the tensor product.
So is a prefactorized algebra just a pre-co-sheaf?
Yeah, exactly. This is just, so it's just a functor from here to here. It's a you know, free co-sheaf. But it has this nice property that sends disjoint unions to tensor products. And that allows me to write down these multiplication maps. Okay. So I've talked about observables of a Dijkgraaf-Witten type theory. Is it a factorization algebra? Well, I know it's a prefactorization algebra. So is it a factorization algebra? And the answer is sometimes. So this is a great spot where we can see very precisely what factorization algebras are good and not good for. So this theorem is due to Ayala Francis, and there's a version by Ginot, Tradler, and Zainalian. So this stuff is like 10 years old, and I just feel dumb that I never noticed it back then. Okay? But I don't know, that's the way it goes, I guess. This functor is a factorization algebra under two conditions on the space X. The first one is that the homotopy groups are finite for I less than or equal to N. So just to be really pedantic, if I have different connected components, I mean, and any of the connected components, pi 1 and pi 2 and stuff, are also finite. So you can see that this is less restrictive than what we do in Dyckhoff-Witten theory. In Dyckhoff-Witten theory, people take x to be like literally finite. Here we're just asking for it finite in this range.
So, Owen, do you mean finite or do you mean invertible in the ground field?
Say it again?
Do you mean finite or do you mean of invertible order? Like if I was in positive characteristic, which do you mean?
There's no characteristics here. I haven't done k. I haven't talked about k yet. This is all just...
Okay.
Yeah.
This is really finite. Okay.
Really finite, yeah. So then there's another condition which topologists will like, but is probably less familiar to your average person. X is a nilpotent space. So this means that pi 1 of x is a nilpotent group. Nilpotent roughly means nearly abelian. So abelian is nilpotent at some slight generalization. And pi 1 acts nilpotently on higher homotopy groups. Okay. So this is a genuine restriction. So this is more restrictive Dyckhoff-Witten. It can't see non-nilpotent things effectively. I have a prefactorization algebra. It's just not a factorization algebra. Knowing the local behavior doesn't determine the global behavior unless X is of this type. Yeah.
So these are sufficient conditions. Is there anything about...
Yeah, so the proof is by sort of like classic algebraic topology. It uses something called the Eilenberg-Mohr spectral sequences. And I haven't dug too deep into it, but it, so this goes back to results of Bill Dwyer, and it seems to be pretty sharp. Like, you're kind of stuck here. The Eilenberg-Mohr spectral sequence really only behaves nicely for nilpotent spaces. So it seems to be like it's exactly in that range. But I agree. It might be that there's cases where you can get out of this. These are sufficient. I don't know if they're necessary. Okay. Okay, I'm getting short on time. So I'm going to say something out loud rather than writing it on the board. So I want to do one more example. So we just compared to Dyckhoff-Witten, and like, there's some partial overlap of what x's are allowed as targets. What kind of data do you get back? Well, we can see that for a codimension, for like a manifold that looks like R cross an n minus 1 manifold, I'm getting exactly the answer you got from Dyckhoff-Witten as the vector space. H0 of this mapping space is what we were saying is the vector space of the functorial field theory. But it doesn't know the path integral part. It just knows the observables. It's not implementing the path integral part. So it's missing some of that too. So my last 5 minutes, I just described what might be called the observables of Dyckhoff-Witten theory in good cases as a factorization algebra. A question to ask is, at least if you're familiar with what we've used factorization algebras for in the past, you could also ask, can I encode symmetries using factorization algebras? So there's an analogous construction to encode symmetries, some sort of version of the currents you might be interested in. And what I'm going to do is I want to replace cochains with chains, and I'm going to replace maps with compactly supported maps. And if you studied like enveloping factorization algebras, you recognize this is somehow very similar. So there's a composite map to topological spaces, and then to chain complexes. This is going to be chains, and this is going to be compactly supported maps. So let me tell you what that is. So I'm going to pick a base point for X. So it's going to be a base space. In the case of something like BG, there's just sort of one, there's a natural base point you'd like. And then maps that are compactly supported from a manifold into this base space. I'll just be lazy and call it X most of the time. R phi from M to X, of course, continuous or smooth or whatever you want, such that if you look at the pre-image of X minus its base point, so you look away from the point X, this is an open set. This has compact closure. In other words, its support is compact. Okay. Now this, taking compactly supported maps also sends disjoint unions to the product. And so if we have a Kunithi kind of thing here, we again get a prefactorization algebra. You could ask, when is it a factorization algebra? Like we did here. And there's a very beautiful theorem known as the non-abelian Poincaré duality theorem. Has a kind of complicated history, but I'll credit it to Salvatore and Lurie with other proofs by other people. And here the condition is different. This functor is a factorization algebra. If the homotopy groups pi I X, that this base point is 0 for I less than or equal to n minus 1. People call this n connective. Okay. So I want to point out what this construction does just to connect it with symmetries, and then I'll be done. Okay, so examples here. Suppose I took n equals 1 and g any discrete group. Then, of course, bg is 0 connective. It's connected, but it has interesting pi 1. So what I assign, what this functor assigns to say the real line or any open interval, sorry, this is the compactly supported maps, and say the real line into BG with coefficients in K. Well, this thing here is the based loops of BG, which by standard algebraic topology is homotopy equivalent to G, or weakly homotopy equivalent to G. And so what we're seeing here is quasi-isomorphic to, actually is an algebra, it's the group ring. Okay. So this is really nice. Like if I took a lattice, I'm getting, say, the group ring of the lattice. This is nice. This is something that I was missing before. And I think you can see why having an action, this is a remark, a symmetry, sort of a representation maybe, think about a representation, is a map from G to endomorphisms of F vector space, but you would also view it as an algebra map from the group ring into here. And so a symmetry, a G symmetry of a factorization algebra F might be thought of as a map from this factorization algebra, chains, compactly supported maps, BG, to F. It's some way of saying the group G acts on the observables. Okay, so this kind of thing lets you sort of formulate things in an intrinsic factorization algebra way. And the people who love all this causal duality stuff can also tackle it in those terms as a more Cartan kind of element. In higher dimensions, of course, you can't use BG because it's not connective. But if it is abelian, you can put it as high as you want. And you again get back a group ring by this process. Okay. So the takeaway is, maybe just to finish up, there are two factorization algebras that play kind of the role of observables of, say, a finite group gauge theory, or more the generalizations people study in TFT land, or allow you to talk about sort of discrete symmetries in a factorization language, but under some conditions. And so I think the next step is to ask how to get these things to couple to the kind of factorization algebras we've seen coming directly from like action functionals, like say these perturbative things. And if we can do that, there's like lots of interesting possibilities there. All right, I'm done. Thank you for listening. Questions?
Okay. How would you relate this to Telemann's ICM about sort of thinking about G actions on two-dimensional theories as being boundaries of a pure three-dimensional, I always hear that described as a story about having groups act on.
Right. So part of my statement is that sort of story where they draw these pictures about having something on the boundary and something on the bulk, like I can now at least write down these discrete group type things in the bulk. Mm-hmm. And so what I need to then do, so I did this thing, but really a better thing would be to map to the center of this thing. So if you had a 2D field theory, it's viewed as a 2D factorization algebra. Its center is supposed to be a 3D factorization algebra. So you could ask for a map from this 3D factorization algebra to it. And then you'd have this action of the 3D bulk theory on the boundary thing. So you could implement a factorization version of all those pictures. Yeah, you're making a squinchy face. What does that mean?
Well, I'm there's two things that are confusing. Well, one's a complaint and one's a question. So the complaint is that you've only written down the, of course, the position type observables. You didn't write down any of the kind of a TIF type, you know, the sort of, like you didn't do a quantum theory. You just wrote down the observables on mapping spaces.
Absolutely. But
that's fine. Those are important. I'm confused by how this theorem on the middle board could be true. Like,
okay.
Thought that sort of, you know, in the case that this certainly includes should be something like just an abelian group Diagraph-Witten theory, no higher anything. At which point I would have thought that these chain complexes were all rationally acyclic. And so I don't see how locally they could have any information in them at all, but globally they still seem to.
Well, if you just look at H0, they don't have anything, but they know as much as like the Eilenberg-MacLane space, right?
I think the Theo's complaint is when you tensor the Eilenberg-MacLane space with the Q.
But I don't have to be in Q. I could pick K to be sort of.
Oh, I agree that you could have gotten something interesting in other fields, but you claim something for any ground ring K, and I don't see how that could be true.
It has to be something where Kunneth works.
But this works over any field.
Yeah, this works over any field, I think.
Well, then I just don't under. I think there, as I said, I'm somehow failing to understand something. Like if X is a disk, then. I mean, not X is a disk. If your manifold is a disk,
mm-hmm.
Then you're asking me to write down the chain complex for BG.
Yes.
The chain complex for BG has one dimension of cohomology in degree zero and no cohomology anywhere else if G has order co-primed with the characteristic.
Uh-huh.
And so that chain complex is on a disk seems to be just the trivial one-dimensional chain complex. And yet if X wasn't a disk, then I could have something showing up in HC. Like my complaint is that your chain complex is double. If you're in characteristic away from the order of the group, then your chain complexes just have no cohomology at all outside of degree zero. So how could it be a factorization? But that's what I'm kind of not understanding.
I don't think I have a good answer off the cuff. I'm just sort of using it as a thing from off-the-shelf literature. So we should talk about it. I don't have a good answer.
Okay. Lucas in the chat writes, I think it also uses the E-infinity structure on the chains.
Yeah, absolutely. On the co-chains.
Well, maybe I'm just not understanding something, but...
So, right, if you think about the co-chains as an E-infinity algebra, it knows a lot more than just taking, like, the cohomology.
Yes.
So I don't, except, yeah, maybe.
If I'm kind of in order away from the characteristic, then the co-chains is like the map to just the ground field, whatever, the augmentation or co-augmentation, those are quasi-isomorphisms of chain complexes and they're E-infinity maps. So they're quasi-isomorphisms of the infinity algebras.
I don't see what's bad. I mean,
internet is unstable.
We work over Q. We take some space, which happens to be trivial over Q. Might as well be a point. The construction works for a point.
Yes. I mean, what I'm confused by is that BG, it looks trivial over Q. I mean, I think that BG is trivial over Q, but that doesn't mean that the mapping stack from a manifold to BG is trivial. The mapping stack from a manifold to BG looks like a set over Q, but it doesn't look trivial over Q.
I see it.
So it seems like what this factorization algebra can see, like if a theorem like this is true, it seems like it's not really doing what Owen said about maps from M to BG. It looks like it's like the maps that are somehow kind of perturbatively close to the trivial connection.
That wouldn't be good. Okay.
Is there something?
That's what I'm confused about. I just if I have like a
wait.
And characteristic P, I'm very happy to believe this that something like this would be interesting.
I think maybe Milman did this stronger than he said it was.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, like normally you have not every abelian group is pronotal. So I'm imagining that the correct Nolan-Leibniz condition will mean that all maps really are very close to the trivial map.
Okay.
Yeah, then I'm much more happy to believe this.
Okay. I just copied this condition from a book, so I don't know if it's, it's not in my... So great, Theo, you're on the hook to talk with me about this.
No good deed goes unpunished.
That's right. That's the principle.
If there are no more questions, we should thank the speaker again.